all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry and I have the privilege of being your host this Sunday for our program. We've got a great, great program today and I really want to make sure that you gather all your friends and family, all the veterans that you know to gather around the radio and listen to this program because we're going to be talking with a therapist who has been working with soldiers coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan on their bases. It's kind of a new counselor system, and I'll let her describe it when we come back after the break. But her name is Elizabeth Haney, and Elizabeth has written a book called The Honor Was Mine, and she talks about her experiences working with these young soldiers, male and female, and the anxiety that they have either being deployed or coming home from being deployed. Those of you who have done this in your life, go back 50 years for many Vietnam veterans. Remember, there weren't any programs available when we came home. And so I think that you're going to find this very helpful for you, especially. So I have the privilege and the honor, after reading her book, of having our guest on the program, and that is Elizabeth Haney. And Elizabeth is an MA, LPC, and for some reason she was a therapist in the civilian world, and she decided that she was going to counsel military personnel. That was something that you probably didn't anticipate, right? So anyway, I want to welcome to our program Elizabeth Haney. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Well, I guess my question to you when I first started reading the book is, why would a therapist on the outside want to get involved with the military?
And to be perfectly honest with you, about a year before I took on this job, I had a colleague that mentioned this work to me, and I thought, oh, no, I would never want to do that. And, you know, things happened in that year. I felt a lot of changes, and it was more, for me, it was more about logistics. It was not because I had a dedication to the military. I wanted to move from where I was living, and I thought this job will move me around the country. I'll get to see other places. Maybe I'll find someplace I want to live next. I mean, I'm just being completely frank with you. It really wasn't about a dedication to the military. When I signed up for the job, I had absolutely no experience with the military whatsoever. My dad was in World War II, but he was not in combat. He was an airplane mechanic stationed in Italy, away from the fighting. And none of my brothers, I have four brothers, none of them served. I have one cousin that was in the Coast Guard, but he lived far away from me. So I had no familiarity with the military at all. So I was walking into a job that I thought, oh, I've been a counselor for 30 years. I can do this. You know, of course. I felt very confident about my counseling skills, but I did not realize that I was walking into a whole different world.
Well, as I mentioned in an email to you earlier in this week, I wish that there had been people like you when many of us came home from Vietnam, because we did not have any counselors available to us. And again, most of us, when we did come home, we went straight home. There wasn't any delay, and we weren't in a group. You know, we went home as individuals, and I think that this, you know, the ability that the military is, what they're attempting to do right now is so much more helpful.
I completely agree. So groups are coming back as a group. They also have a lot of, you know, briefings to do in the week or two that they get back before they're allowed to go on what they call block leave. So they're in a little bit of a container for a while when they first get back. They go on leave, then they all come back together. And really, when I was working on the bases, that was when issues really started to show up, not in those first couple of weeks, but when they got back from leave and really kind of tried to adjust to being back home is when things would get really difficult.
Is this program continuing?
Program is continuing. They place civilian counselors on military bases all over the world. It's not just in the United States. And it's a program through the Department of Defense that has hired this HMO to provide civilian counselors. So I was basically a subcontractor.
Okay. All right.
I worked for the HMO.
Okay, gotcha. I was trying to figure out, how you got there. We're talking with Elizabeth Haney. Her book is The Honor Was Mine, A Look Inside the Struggles of Military Veterans. And I want you to, if you can, to describe, you did a very good job of disguising, I guess you could say, of where you were and, who you were talking to. There are no real names mentioned and so on and so forth. I mean, you did a nice job of explaining that to your readers. But can you kind of describe when you went wherever your first base was? What was your reaction to that? Because most of these bases, you were never there for a long period of time.
I was there anywhere from 3 to 6 months. So actually, that very first assignment, it was originally just a one-month assignment because the battalion was coming back from combat, and they wanted a bunch of counselors to be available for this battalion that was just coming back. Actually, I think it was a whole brigade was coming back, but I was assigned to a battalion. And by the way, I want to say, I typically refer to the folks I worked with as soldiers, but I work with people from all different branches of the military. It just gets really confusing to sort of switch the language with, who I'm talking about. So I just use soldiers as a generic term.
Well, that's a good thing, because even those of us in the military, we don't know what the other branches are talking about.
I use a blanket term. So I was supposed to be there for a month, and then they extended it. I actually ended up being there 3 months. Two stories come to mind. One of them is the very first morning at that very first base, my colleagues and I were supposed to meet at the brigade offices because we have a meeting with one of the brigade commanders going to tell us about the work we're going to do. So we all find the conference room, and we show up. We're sitting down, 9 o'clock in the morning, and pretty soon this female colonel comes striding into the room. These two guys are walking behind her, and she stands at the podium at the front, and she said, "Listen, if you people can't get yourselves here on time, I don't need you in my brigade. So from now on, the expectation," and she went on, and I'm looking at the clock. It's 9 o'clock. We were told to be here at 9 o'clock. We all got there at 9 o'clock. And she started telling us that if we couldn't be there and ready to go 15 minutes early, she didn't need us. And I thought, oh. I'm someone who's very good at being on time, but I thought, I'm in a different world now. Like, on time is 15 minutes early. I'll tell you. I took that in, and for the rest of the time I work with the military, in fact, to this day, when I go to the VA for a meeting or something, I show up 15 minutes early.
If you're early, you're on time. If you're on time, you're late.
That's right. So that was right away. That was within the first few minutes I got kind of slapped down with a bit of reality. I am really in a different world here.
Well, how did that world accept you as a civilian counselor?
They didn't.
Okay.
They didn't. Yeah. Especially this was early on. This was when I first started, was close to 9 years ago. So it was really not too long after the height of the combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. So there was still a lot going on. But I wasn't a trustable person at all to them. First of all, I'm a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
So what do I know? Secondly, I'm female. So they, for the most part, they don't have time for me. And thirdly, I'm a counselor. Like, I'm going to try to make them talk about things. Like, they really had so little interest in me. And what I learned was I needed to just relax and sort of get in sync with their world. This was completely different than private practice.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to just slow down and really sort of let them get to know me. So every time I started at a new base, I would spend about 6 weeks basically chatting with people in the motor pools, in the dining facilities, in the battalion offices, in the work bays, because I felt like I'm letting them get to know me. I'm letting them check me out and see if I'm somebody they want to talk to, I mean, frankly, that turned out to be a really, really great way to approach it. I had colleagues that would walk up to them and basically, like, ask them intensive questions right away, and it just wasn't a way to do this work. At all.
No, it's very difficult for a soldier to talk to a civilian about what they did. We just don't think that you'd ever understand what we've been through or, why we're anxious or whatever the scenario may be. I can remember talking to a counselor when I first got back from Vietnam, and it was a civilian at the VA hospital, and they were asking questions that I didn't think were necessary, and I just said, never mind. I'll take all my stuff with me and go home for about 30 years or so. So
I hear that kind of story all the time. I really do, even today. All the folks that I see in my private practice, all the combat veterans I see, originally have tried to get help at the VA or, you know, some organization, and they run into that kind of thing still. Where, you know, one recent combat vet that I started working with, he said, well, I went to the VA, and I said, well, tell me what happened. And he said, you know, there's a guy sitting there that's probably been out of grad school maybe 2 or 3 years. And he said, I get it. He's so earnest. Like, he really wants to help. You know, the second or third question he asked me was, so tell me what happened downrange. And I just thought, oh, my goodness. Every veteran I work with walks in the door and says, I'm not going to talk about combat. I'm like, okay, fine. Maybe months down the road we'll start talking about that. But, you know, they want to make that clear from the beginning, like, back off, try to get me to open up about that. I respect that. I totally respect that.
Can you talk to us a little bit about Sergeant Gallagher?
Yeah. You know, I have that story right here if you'd like me to read it. I don't know if you...
A little bit of it. Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, Sergeant Gallagher, I was standing outside one of the barracks with a couple of soldiers, and one of them is very chatty. We've been talking quite a bit. He went inside to get another pack of cigarettes, so I'm left with the second one. And the second one is Sergeant Gallagher, and he's this totally buttoned-up guy. I mean, he is literally, I'm standing on the sidewalk next to him, and he's looking around, staring off at the parade field like he's not even talking to me. So I just was chatting. I said, oh, you know, where are you from? And he's just giving me one-word answers. So I decide, well, that's not really going to work out. You know, I just don't want to keep tossing him questions. So I just sort of fade out, and I just ask him, hey, what do you do for fun? And what he does outside of the battalion offices? And he begins to relax. So I'll start reading just a little bit here. Mm-hmm. He talks about playing flag football on the weekends and enjoying fishing in nearby rivers. He tells me about his pit bull mix and his fondness for barbecuing. When he mentions a new F-150 truck, I ask about it, and he launches into a long description of, quote, the beast. The subject matter stays light, and Gallagher seems comfortable, and we end up talking for a good 15 minutes before the other one comes back out saying he got delayed. So I'm thinking we've made a little bit of progress. I make sure to shake his hand before I leave. And I don't know how effectively I've broken through his natural reticence until the next afternoon. Just after lunch, Gallagher walks in and sits down in one of the chairs. Afternoon, ma'am. Afternoon, Gallagher. What's up? Well, if it's okay, I want to talk to you. So I nod. He pulls the chair closer and straightens it so it's at a direct angle to the front of my desk. I think my girlfriend's getting ready to leave me. Gallagher leans forward, puts his elbows on his knees, and clasps his hands together like he's considering a detailed battle plan or an intricate play in a basketball game. His face shows no emotion, but his manner is deeply earnest as he talks about this painful turn of events. As a 68 Whiskey, which is a combat medic, Gallagher tells me he learned not to share too much after 3 deployments downrange. He's dealt with horrific things, friends getting blown up or dying, innocent locals who were hurt, maimed, or killed. He carries all those memories inside him. The voice he uses to describe his work and experiences is flat. He's learned very well how to contain his feelings. Watching him, I realize he doesn't even let himself know the feelings he has. His eyes never leave mine, as if he's trained himself not to let his gaze turn away from anything. He says, anyway, nobody needs to know about all that stuff downrange. My girlfriend keeps asking me why I don't talk about my work. She says she wants to know, quote, everything about me. She doesn't need to know that stuff. When I ask him what he can share with her, he looks at me with a blank face. I have no idea, ma'am. So we spend the next hour talking about the kinds of things he might want to share with her. What he did at the office that day, conversations he had, who he ran into in the hallways, things he thought about doing during work, the small things that make up his day. Whenever I give him a suggestion, he says, Roger, and nods his head definitively as if I just coached him on the next move in the basketball game. After the first couple of suggestions, he pulls a pen and a small notebook out of his pocket and begins writing down the list of ideas. Roger, Roger.
I didn't mean to cut you off there. I'm just thinking of the checklist that everybody always wrote down. You know, okay, I'll do this, I'll do that, and then everything will be perfect.
Yes, and that was exactly how he was approaching counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I have to say, you know, he's a really good example of how, you know, locked away the folks coming back from combat had to be, and how difficult it was to try to figure out what to open up to their loved ones, how much to open up, what was okay to talk about. Like, they were lost.
Yeah, I agree, because you don't necessarily want to scare your family.
Right.
You know, you want to know everything I did. Well, if I tell you everything I did, you won't think I'm the nice person I was when I left.
That's exactly right.
You know, because there's always these stories that I've heard, and even my father was one of these, and I wasn't aware of it, of course, at the time. But my sister would always talk about my dad before he went to World War II, and then the dad that came home after World War II. He wasn't the funny dad anymore. And, you know, I thought he was funny. I didn't know the difference. But as I learned more and more, you know, of course, he never talked to me about it at all. But with my own experiences, finding out that, yes, the carefree, you know, kid that you were before you go off to combat is not the same carefree kid that you come home as, because you've seen things that you never imagined in your life.
Yeah.
that you would ever see. I mean, you talk about a lot of these things in the book. We're talking with Elizabeth Haney. Her book is The Honor Was Mine. She's a contract therapist who worked with these men and women as they went to battle and they came back from battle. And you talk about, where is that? Oh, separation anxiety. Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, separation anxiety, you know, I was working with people who were getting ready to deploy. Sometimes they were leaving in the next week, or maybe in the next 24 hours. And they were grappling with what that meant. Like, what was it going to be like to be away from their loved ones? I was working with folks who were mostly deploying for a year. And that's a substantial thing to face, to have, you know, to be gone for a year in these unbelievably difficult situations and not have the support of your wife or your husband or your kids or your parents. It's deeply, deeply affecting.
I was thinking about that. You know, you talk a lot later on, you talk about spouses and you know, as we mentioned before, the warriors and caregivers types of things. And I was thinking about that just with my own mom. Is you know, she had already sent her husband off to World War II for 3 years, and then I go off and fight my little war for a year. What was going through her head? And of course, it wasn't a conversation we ever had, unfortunately.
Oh, but yeah.
You know, what was she thinking? And you know, what were her anxieties? And of course, I was married just before I went to Vietnam. What was going on in my wife's head? What are you doing here? You know, you're going off for a year. You're going to come back. You're not going to come back. You know, how do these things work? I think that a lot of these things are what veterans in general have to think about and probably have thought about. And because of people like you now, they've got somebody that they can open up to if they want to.
Yes. They've got people willing to listen if they want to open up. Yes. Which you did not have.
No, but the idea is here, and I'm not trying to make this all about me. I don't mean to get off on that tangent. But when I was reading a book, it was just every other page I'd say, oh, I know that guy. Oh, I know that story. Oh, I recognize that one. And it was so powerful to me that I can only say that I recommend that it is something that all of our listeners need to read and to just sit down and go through. I think it will explain a lot about behavior. It will explain a lot about the reticence to talk about what may occur and what may not occur, and you know, what they want to share and what they don't want to share. It's such a hard job, and I have to give you all the credit that I have already done, which I will give you more as we go along, about the idea of sitting down and actually finally getting some of these men and women to talk about their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so... Anyhow, so we're going to be coming up here on a break. So I want to a couple of things I want to talk about after the break is that the honor and integrity that you discovered while you were talking with these soldiers that you weren't aware of as a civilian coming in, and then we'll talk about your reactions that you had after so many months of talking to these men and women, and sort of your secondary post-traumatic stress that you developed on your own. Just to remind people that this is a volunteer army.
Yeah.
These men and women are deployed more than once. In many cases, 3, 4, 5 times, in even more cases than that, it seems. And so we have to remember that I'll let you tell it. You describe these men and women that you've met over the years.
You know, the truth is I met remarkable men and women, and that was another thing I didn't really understand going into this work. The caliber of the people that I would meet and work with was astounding to me. I feel like they dedicate themselves to something bigger than themselves. And that's an experience I think most civilians maybe don't have the opportunity to do or don't understand. You know, those folks that sign up to serve are putting themselves on the line, and they're accepting a responsibility and a burden that most of us don't accept and don't shoulder. And I came to deeply respect them for that. It was so moving to me to realize what they were doing in choosing to serve. And whether it's peacetime or war, they're saying, I'm available for what you send me to do. Whether it's rescuing people from the hurricane in Haiti or going off to combat or rescue mission somewhere else, it's a whole mix of things. But just that dedication to say, I'm available, I'm actually giving up, you know, my day-to-day life, my freedom to come and serve and protect. It's so deeply moving to me, and I do feel like civilians don't quite understand that. I feel like civilians get caught up in what they think politically about war, or they get caught up in what they think about, you know, combat or these other countries. And they don't really understand just the essence, regardless of all that, just the essence of having these people who step up and say, I will serve.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And as you pointed out in the book also, you know, most military personnel are not big fans of war. Nobody wants to go to war. There are no organizations out there that says, yay, veterans for war. But, you know, we realize that we have a duty to perform and that we do that duty as long as we can. And then we get out or we stay in, depending on what the scenario happens to be. This is what got me hooked on the book, folks. if you get the opportunity, really go out and find this. It's The Honor It Was Mine by Elizabeth Haney. It's Haney. And it's on Amazon and probably every place else that you can get them. During the break, I was looking at the prologue about Springer. But talk about him just a little bit, could you?
So Corporal Springer was someone that he had been back from deployment about 6 years. He came in to see me, and he's talking about PTSD and nightmares and things like that. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue one day, he says, I have to tell you something else. Like, he's told me a lot of things, and he suddenly says, I have to tell you something else. And I said, okay. And he said, sometimes I hide in my closet. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, my. And it was like the room just went still, and I just waited for him to say more. And I said, you feel safer in there. It gets quiet, and everything feels safe, right? He said, yeah. And then he looked up at me, and he said, but I have to tell you something else. And I said, okay. So he says he was hiding in his closet one day, and he hears his dad out in the house calling his name. But he can't get himself to move, and he can't get himself to respond because he's still so freaked out. And he hears his dad getting closer and closer, and dad walks into the bedroom and calls his name. Springer still can't say anything. And then the dad starts to leave, but at the last minute, he walks over and he opens up the closet door, and he looks inside and he sees Springer, you know, kind of curled up in the corner. He said that his dad just got down on his hands and knees and crawled into the closet with him and took him in his arms, and they both just sat there and cried like babies. And I'll tell you something, Dale. I read that at one of the readings I did here in North Carolina several months ago, an audience of about 100 people, and many in the audience had military backgrounds. Two different wives walked up to me at the end and said, that's my story. My husband has done that.
Mm-hmm.
So people think this is such an unusual thing. What? You hide in your closet? Like, what? And two different people came up to me and said, yeah, my husband did that too.
You know, one of the things that I discovered, many of my friends now, my veteran friends, of course, is that when we sit around and we tell our own stories to each other, it makes us realize that we're not that unique, that, mm-hmm. you know, that we're having similar issues with whatever, you know, whatever they might be. And that sometimes that it's very helpful to the group therapy sessions that sometimes they have at the VA, or the ones that we kind of are unofficial, you know, breakfasts mm-hmm. every once in a while, that, you know, to laugh and to cry and to make people realize, you know, that you're human, you know, you're all right. You got friends and, you know, we're here to help, you know, help you get through whatever it is that you're going through right now. But that particular story of the dad getting in the closet with him just really broke my heart. And, you know, Springer also says, you know, before he kind of announces that story, he says, you know, I'm not crazy.
He kept repeating that to me. He kept saying, I'm not crazy, ma'am. And I'd say, okay, you're not crazy.
No, you're not. So you had to deal with a lot of these stories just like that.
Just like that. The level of trauma that I was dealing with day in and day out was just almost ungraspable. You know, like I said, I've been a therapist for 30 years. I had, you know, worked with lots and lots of people and people in trauma. But I'd never worked with that kind of just one person after another, after another, after another, with these really horrific stories of trauma.
How did that affect you?
Well, eventually, small things started happening that now, looking back, I sort of added up differently. But, you know, I noticed I was having trouble sleeping at night because I was talking to so many people all day long. I would lay down to go to sleep, and my mind would just keep reviewing who I had talked to and what they had told me. And I don't do that day to day with my counseling practice, but this was so intense that it's like I couldn't turn it off. After I finished one of my assignments, I think it was maybe, I don't know, the sixth or seventh assignment, I went to visit a friend and she's chatting with me. We're outside, it's a lovely day, and she's talking about something and I realized I couldn't even follow what she was saying. I thought I'd just have to try harder, and I couldn't. It was like she was speaking Swahili or something. Like, I could not process what she was saying. Within the next couple of days, what I realized was I just was getting more and more and more frantic, and I couldn't really listen to people. And I spoke to a colleague of mine, and she said, do you realize you have secondary PTSD? And I said, no. She said, the symptoms are lining up perfectly. You can't sleep. You can't hear anything. You get overstimulated in a half a second. So when she said that, I said, well, I don't know what to do. And she said, well, you know, you want to stay with someone where you feel safe and everything feels, you know, calm and relaxed so your nervous system can quiet down. And she even told me that if I could go out for a run, that would be really good because my nervous system was in fight or flight. So let it run. And of course, I got myself into therapy with a very good trauma therapist. But it took about a year and a half to get it to quiet back down. So during that year and a half, I was on edge all the time. I lost things. I'm not someone that loses things. I kept losing keys and the top to this and the bottom half of that. And, you know, I just kept losing things. I was dysregulated all the time. I had a hard time going to the grocery store because I would get so overstimulated. I would want to leave. And I'll tell you, Dale, the sort of silver lining of all that is that when I continued working with combat veterans, I knew so much more about what they were talking about. And before that, I only knew it from book learning. You know, I knew PTSD from a book.
Right.
When the combat veteran clients came in after that, and they would say, I'm really struggling with PTSD in whatever way, the sleep or mostly the anxiety, I could look them dead in the eye and say, I know.
Well, that's the advantage of having somebody like you as a counselor. And so one of the questions that you seem to run into fairly often was from the spouses. What's going to happen when my so-and-so gets home?
I remember one base I was sent to, and the battalion was mostly deployed to Afghanistan. There was just the rear detachment at the base, but all the spouses were there. And in about 2 weeks, all the soldiers were going to come home. At that particular base, it was all wives. There was one male spouse. And what I noticed was how profoundly anxious they were about who was going to come home. They didn't know how changed their husband was going to be. So I had one after another, especially young wives. Maybe they had just gotten married, you know, not too long before their husband deployed, that were coming to my office and sitting down and saying, I want a divorce. And, I mean, it was happening session after session after session. I want a divorce. I want a divorce. I want a divorce. And I realized they're just anxious. Like, they think that's the answer to the anxiety. And I worked really hard to get them to sort of slow down and figure out some ways to cope with the anxiety and hopefully help them understand, like, their husband's anxious, too. You know, he doesn't know how much you've changed. But that was very striking to me that you think homecoming, oh, it's going to be so wonderful and amazing. And really, these women were experiencing levels of anxiety that they just couldn't manage.
No, that's, I can understand that. You know, just the anxiety of coming home, you just don't know what's going to happen. And one of the things that you find is that many of your friends, you think they've changed, and then you realize that it's you that has changed. And
that's so true.
And trying to figure out, okay, now how do I fit back into this group of people? And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Before we run out of time, I want to make sure that we talk about your assignment. You're working at a base that handled the remains of the bodies and their belongings.
That's correct. I wasn't actually working in the morgue. I was working in a facility that processed the belongings of soldiers who had been killed or wounded in action. It was this really huge building that had little separate areas. They would clean and catalog and tag every single item that they would get from the service members' footlockers would be delivered to this building. And they would take and they would open it up. They literally had washing machines in every area. They had all kinds of cleaning materials. And they would clean and fold and beautifully take care of. I mean, I saw them cleaning the bottom of a soldier's boot with Q-tips to get all the dirt off of it. And then, after they cleaned it, and it was spick and span clean, they would take oil and rub into the bottom of it to make the rubber, or whatever it was, look brand new. They would take and wash the shoelaces in the boots, and then they would put them back in the boot, and they would cross them over the same way, one over the other, all the way up the front of the boot. They would take all of their clothing and fold it all to the exact same size and stack it just pristinely back inside the footlocker, which had also been cleaned. They saved a gum wrapper. I was walking by a place and in one of the work areas, and I saw a guy catalog a wrinkled up gum wrapper. And I said, what are you going to do with that? And he said, well, we're going to put it in a Ziploc and send it home. I said, why would you do that? It's a gum wrapper. He said, because we never know. This could mean something to one of, you know, to his wife or his sisters. Dad, you know, maybe they always had this kind of gum together. Maybe one of his buddies gave him this kind of gum to help him stop smoking. Like, we don't make any judgment call. We just make sure the family gets the whole story back. And these people that were working in there, it was a combination of civilian and veterans and active duty. Some of them had waited for years to get a position in that facility because the work meant so much to them. And I say in the book, it was like working in a church. To work in that environment. They were so pristinely dedicated to the work they were doing and to making sure that the families back home got the belongings back in the most beautiful way they possibly could. You know, they're reading the background of the soldier whose belongings they're working on, and, you know, he was from a town right next to mine. You know, they had a very personal relationship with the belongings as they processed them. And I was so proud to support those folks.
Can you talk about the one time when you were outside and everybody sitting around the picnic tables and so forth? And
Sure. So one day there was a break area out behind the building. There was a little grassy area, had picnic tables, and the entire building would take a break at the same time. So lots of people would go out there and smoke cigarettes or, you know, drink sodas or whatever, hang out at the picnic table. So I'm out there with everybody else because that's a good time to chat with people. And all of a sudden, the entire area goes completely silent. And I look around. I don't understand what's happened. And people start standing up from the picnic table. They don't leave. They're just standing up. And I look around. I still don't understand. And I kind of look quizzically at the woman standing next to me. And she said, there's a plane coming. And sure enough, right behind that break area was an access to the runway, and there was a very small jet slowly rolling down that access road to get to the top of the runway. And she said, there's always remains on those jets. Every time one of those jets went by, if these folks were outside, they all went completely silent, stood still facing that runway, and honored that service member, that fallen service member, as the jet slowly rolled by. And there's a part in the book where I talk about one of the commanders, and he rushed by me to go back in the building before the plane came by. And one of them told me later it was because he didn't have his hat on. And he thought it was disrespectful to be out there while the remains went by without his hat on. He chose to go inside rather than disrespect that soldier.
It just goes to show you folks, you know, that the real people out there that are, you know, helping our veterans and helping them survive, and even when they don't survive, that they're honoring their memory. You know, the idea of folding everything perfectly, and even that gum wrapper just broke my heart. And speaking of hearts, you mentioned something about one of your lines was that your job was catching hearts. Talk about that just real briefly.
Yeah, what I was talking about was people would say to me, like, how can you do this work? Like, how can you work in that kind of intensity? You know, it's hard to express how meaningful that work is to this day, how meaningful and fulfilling it is for me to work with combat veterans. But while I was on the bases and there was so much happening and so many stories I was tracking and so many people asking for help, and so I wrote the line. That's the best way I had to express it. I said, I felt like every day I was catching hearts falling through the air. That image came to me one day where I felt like I'm just reaching out to catch this heart falling, and then right as I catch it, I've got to turn quickly another way to catch another one, and then, oh, here comes another one falling. That was a sort of an artistic way of saying, like, that's what that experience felt like. I was catching hearts falling through the air.
Wow. Well, Elizabeth Haney, thank you very, very much for being on Veterans Radio. We've come up again to the top of the hour. That always goes so much faster than I anticipated. you're working with a new organization out there that you mentioned in an email to me. Is it Centerstone?
Centerstone Military Services. So they specifically find counseling and support for combat veterans, and they are linked up with Wounded Warrior Project. So people can either call Centerstone Military Services or Wounded Warrior Project, and they offer services for free. So they'll hook you up with a counselor or a recovery process of some kind, retreats or something, at no charge. So I think it's absolutely wonderful service.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure talking to you, and the book is The Honor Was Mine, Look Inside the Struggles of Military Veterans, Elizabeth Haney, H-E-A-N-E-Y. She's an award-winning author with the Military Writers Society of America, my good friends over there, so they're the ones that turned me on to the book. So I want to thank you again. Hope to
thank
have you back.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.